If you think alcoholism is a yes or no problem, then you're seeing alcohol problems right now the way people saw cancer 2,500 years ago, and you're behind the curve. It's time to catch up.
Welcome to the Ignited Recovery Podcast, a new way forward for anyone looking for answers but feeling left out. If you've been searching for empowerment, triumph, and purpose, you found them right here. You won't hear the same solutions, and you're not going to have any excuses to fall back on, because Ignited Recovery allows heroes to rise and become their best selves. I'm Dr. Adi Jaffe, and I can't wait to be your guide on this journey. Are you ready to become an Ignited Hero?
I have to tell you all something. Alcoholism is dead. It's been dead for a long time, and I already did an entire episode on how all or nothing, yes or no, alcoholic or normal, doesn't work at all anymore. But I want to make it so clear today that the entire concept of alcoholism just needs to disappear. This is continuing on the same theme as before, and for those of you who remember from the last conversation, so the DSM already recognizes three levels, low, moderate, and severe of alcohol issues. But I want to talk a little bit here on what I see as being next. And so, yes, we talked about binary yes or no last time. We're going to dive in much more deeply into the history of alcoholism as a label itself and go beyond that. So for those of you who don't know, the concept that alcohol use problems are a disease came up in the early 1800s. Yes, y'all, the early 1800s. We're talking over 200 years ago. Dr. Benjamin Rush, he is referred to actually in some of the early books, talked about habitual drunkenness as a concept that is a disease. It's a medical condition. He was a physician. It was a medical condition. Not a big surprise, right? Doctors see things as diseases. Magnus Haas, a Swedish physician, changed the language there about 40 years later, 1849, and called it alcoholism. An ism. We made it an ism. It was a medical condition, still a disease, as mentioned before. It's 2021, everybody, about to be 2022. So we're talking somewhere around 200 years ago when this became a thing. Now, right around the same time, there was something called the temperance movement going on. For those of you who don't know what the temperance movement, it started all also in the early 18 to mid 1800s. And it was essentially a movement promoting maybe a little bit of moderation, but primarily complete abstinence from intoxicating liquor. This was primarily church-based, moved by large organizations within churches. And by the late 1800s, it had taken on quite a form. This was going to lead into prohibition in the U.S. And one of the terms that they used, one of the first times I could find reference to it, was in the 1870s, was the term alcoholist, I-S-T, for people who drank even though alcohol was evil. Within a few years, by about 1891, we see the first reference to the actual term alcoholic. So now we've got that merger, right? Alcoholism is a disease from the early 1800s. By the late 1800s, alcoholics are people who drink even though alcohol is evil. Pretty quickly here, we're going to make the leap to alcoholics having alcoholism. And so then we jump right into prohibition between 1919 and 1933. Alcohol was completely illegal in this country. You know, we talk about legalization and decriminalization, etc. Alcohol was illegal 1919 to 1933 in this country. The temperance movement had gotten the change that it wanted and had made alcohol something that was illegal to access. The idea was because it's illegal, people would stop drinking. Did that happen? No, of course it didn't happen. Just because you tell people not to do something, especially something that allows them to escape their everyday life, doesn't mean that they're actually going to stop doing it. Look at the 1980s commercials and movement around the Just Say No campaign around drugs. Didn't exactly eliminate drugs in this world. So 1933, alcohol becomes legal again, and it's right around this time between 1931 and 1935, right before alcohol becomes legal again and prohibition is repealed, and 1935 with the formation of Alcoholics Anonymous, that there's this movement from these highly religious Christian, religious Oxford groups into some of their members creating Alcoholics Anonymous. So just to be clear, to create the entire picture for us, from the early 1800s to the mid-1930s, we went from drinking heavily and being habitually drunk being a disease, to people who have it having a condition called alcoholism, and those people being known as alcoholics. And then in the mid-1930s, there's a group for those people organized by religious organizations called Alcoholics Anonymous. And so the reason I want to do this entire thing is as we kind of get going on this, we're going to get into religious aspects preventing progress to some extent around medicine. And I just want to be clear, Alcoholics Anonymous, for whatever anybody says, came completely from religious organizations around temperance. That was the origin of the group. That's how it got formed through these original Oxford groups. And you can look at the history. You can easily research some of this stuff. Within about 10 to 15 years after that, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, what psychiatrists and psychologists to this day use to make diagnostic assessments about the individuals, the patients that they see, the DSM took on alcoholism as a recognized mental health disorder. That started in 1950, and it lasted for 30 years until 1980, when alcoholism left. Once alcoholism left, it wasn't like having an alcohol problem was no longer a mental health condition. They just split it up into two versions of it. Alcohol abuse, which was lower level problems, and alcohol dependence, which is what most people thought of as alcoholic. So now there was like pre-alcoholic and alcoholic. And then very recently, in the last decade or so, we have moved to the DSM-5 definition, which is an alcohol use disorder that has three levels. So that means you can have a light, moderate, or severe version of an alcohol use disorder. So that's how we got to where we are right now. So just to be clear, the term alcoholic no longer means anything clinically, and alcoholism is not recognized as a mental health issue. The term we use is alcohol use disorder, but I want to go even farther than that. And that is because what we're seeing is a move from yes or no, alcoholic or normal, to this more graduated sense. But right now we have three levels, and I want to show you where I think this is going, because three levels is nowhere near enough to describe what is actually happening, which is a near complete continuum of people who struggle with drinking. So what we're going to do here today is something I've never done before really on the podcast, and that is we're going to take a deep dive into a completely different problem, look at its evolution, and use that as an idea-generating moment, as a moment to become creative about where the concept of alcoholism is going. We'll see, unfortunately, probably over the next 30 to 50 years is probably what we have to wait for. But here at Ignited, we're trying to make that happen faster. So we're going to use cancer as the example, all right? I'm going to take you through the history of cancer, and you're going to see so many parallels between the two, and we're going to use that history of cancer to understand where alcoholism is going. So let's start diving right into that. So the first time that the term related to cancer was mentioned was by the Greek physician Hippocrates. Obviously, everybody knows about the Hippocratic Oath. This guy's considered the father of medicine, and he used a term carcinoma to describe tumors. In Greek, this word carcinoma refers to crab, which is why, you know, in the astrological sign, cancer is a crab. But he applied it to the disease because there's like finger-like spreading projections from cancer that in his mind called the shape of a crab. This is 2,500 years ago, 460 BC or so. And he believed, this is back in the humor theory of medicine in general, that the body had these four bodily fluids, humors, that were blood, phlegm, yellow, and black bile. So four different fluids, blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile. And they were balanced, everybody was healthy. When they weren't balanced, you were sick. An excess of black bile in different areas of the body were what he thought caused cancer. That same theory was passed from Hippocrates to the Romans and moved forward all the way to 1300 years later through the Middle Ages. So for about 1300 years, that was the theory of disease in general and cancer in particular. Black bile was what was supposed to cause cancer. Now here's an interesting thing, and I told you I was going to mention how religion comes into all of this. During that time, you couldn't do autopsies. You couldn't cut into a dead body. Why? Because that was prohibited for religious reasons. So everybody came up with theories about what happened around death, but people couldn't cut into dead bodies because of the limitation religiously. So for 1300 years, this was not really looked at much. But then in the mid-1600s or so, so about 500, almost 450, 500 years ago, these two doctors in Holland started thinking that cancer was actually contagious, right? So they thought you could catch cancer from other people. And the reason they believed that was because they were seeing breast cancer in members of the same household. So they were thinking people were giving each other breast cancer in some way. And so what they recommended was that cancer patients should be isolated, especially outside, not just of the home, but outside of cities and towns so that cancer wouldn't spread. And in fact, the first cancer hospital in France was forced to move out of the city in 1779 because people were afraid that cancer would start spreading throughout the city itself. Now, obviously we know cancer is not contagious and we'll talk more about that in a little bit, but I want you to again remember, right, this is erroneous ideas about a disease we now understand better. By the 1700s, about 300 years ago, we moved from the humor theory of these kinds of fluids, right, the four bodily fluids of humors, into this idea that cancer was a formation of another body fluid, the lymph. Lymph is a colorless body fluid coming from the lymph nodes, obviously, that contains white blood cells. And so it was thought that when something was going wrong with lymph fluid, it would cause cancer. And in the early to mid 1700s, John Hunter, a well-known Scottish surgeon, thought that cancer was composed of fermenting or degenerating lymph fluid. And so depending on how dense it was, where it was, and how acidic or alkaline it was, depended on what sort of cancer would get formed. So this is 300 years ago now. It was about 200 years ago that we realized that cancer was actually made of cells and not lymph fluids. And so it took us until 200 years ago, almost 2,300 years after we recognized what cancer is in general, and that it is a condition that happens in the body, for us to understand that cancer cells originated from other cells in the body. Now, for some reason, right in the middle of that, as we realized that this cancer was actually a type of cell that was degenerating from other cells, that some physicians started thinking that trauma to the body was the cause of cancer. They thought, you know, the physical infliction of trauma, being hit, punched, hurt physically in some other way, injured, would cause it, even though for many, many years they tried to cause cancer that way in animals and couldn't really show the generation of cancer. And that leads us to about 1915, a lab in Tokyo University that first found that cancer could be induced in animals by applying coal tar to rabbit skin. So this was the first time that they showed that there's a chemical, what we now know as carcinogens, that when applied to the body could cause skin cancer. So we're talking about a 2,400 year evolution from thinking that cancer was caused by these maladapted fluids flowing through the body and bringing up cancer, and that cancer came from these fluids, to understanding there was a cellular issue, all the way to the fact that there are these chemicals that can be applied, and those chemicals can cause cells to turn carcinogenic. Now, today we obviously recognize that there are a lot of substances that cause cancer. Coal tar is one of them, and all the derivatives from them, like benzene and things like that. And then asbestos and many, many other things that can cause cancer. We call those carcinogens. As of 2014, the WHO, the World Health Organization, identified over 100 chemical, physical, and biological carcinogens. And a lot of them were known, the chemicals themselves were known long before we actually understood how cancer develops, but we're discovering new carcinogens all the time. But I want you to pay attention to the fact that it took us more than 2,000 years to go from recognizing cancer as a thing to understanding how it actually develops and what are the origins of it. Now, over the last literally 40, 50 years, we've actually discovered that genetics and biology do play a big role in them internally. So not just things that come from the outside. So we discovered two kind of families of genes. There are oncogenes, and these are genes that cause cells to grow out of control and become cancer cells. And then there are tumor suppressor genes that can slow down cell division, can repair DNA errors, and actually cause apoptosis or cell death when something goes wrong and cancer starts developing. A perfect example here would be the well-known BRCA gene, right? The BRCA 1 and 2 variants that have been shown to greatly increase the probability of breast cancer. So those would be oncogenes that we know. So in summary, when we talk about this relatively quick history I just gave you of cancer, we're talking about 2,000 years since we've known of cancer to get here where we really understand it, and only really get close in the last 200 years or so. And if you look at where we ended up now, and this will change over time, obviously, because science always does, It actually ended up being a marriage of a few different theories. Cancer is not contagious, but it is made worse by certain viruses which are contagious, and viruses like the human papillomavirus and other things, HPV, have been shown to increase the probability of getting cancer. We also know that cancer is not caused by lymph fluid, but cancer does easily attack lymph nodes and then spread through lymph fluid. So not caused by it, but can be spread by it. It's also not passed to family members in the same household in the way that it was thought of back then, through touch or through the air, but that there are genetic components shared between family members that absolutely can lead to an increase in the probability of cancer. And then it went further. So it took us over 2,000 years to figure out what cancer is and how it gets caused. But then it went further because we realized that cancer is not even a yes or no problem. So over the past 80 years only, people have developed a robust way of grading cancer, really understanding what the cancer is, where it is, how severe it is, the odds of it being successfully healed and things like that. That method is called the tumor node metastasis classification, TNM. And I want to dive into it a little bit because you'll see the difference between how we talk about alcoholism and how we talk about cancer, and it should be pretty clear. So the TNM classification has three areas to it, the T, the N, and the M, obviously. Most of us know of cancer stages, and that's just the T part. So a lot of people will talk of cancer as having four stages, stage 1, 2, 3, and 4, but that's actually not true. Cancer has 6 stages. So you have T0, which is we can't find where exactly the tumor or if it is there. T-is-is, in situ, which means essentially precancerous. And then we have T1, T2, T3, and T4. So 6 different stages of cancer exist. But that just has to do with the level of the tumor itself that's been found, the T. Then there's a node grading, and that has 4 levels. N0, 1, 2, and 3. And then metastasis means outside of the original tumor, have we found cancer being formed in any other way? And that has 2 levels. So at a minimum, cancer actually has 48 possible combinations of grading across this level. 48 levels. And then it gets more complicated because each cancer type has its own version of the TNM categories. So the letters and numbers don't actually mean the same thing for every type of cancer. So, this entire staging process that has been put together to explain cancer has over 48 combinations that exist to describe when somebody has cancer, which I think everybody can agree is very different than saying, do you have cancer or do you not have cancer, right? Because now we have this very gradient, like continuum-like level of explaining how far along the cancer is, how far it's gotten from where it originated, how serious and spread it is, etc., etc., etc. So who cares? Why is this important? Why should you even pay attention to this whole thing? Well, the reason is we're trying to cure cancer. We're trying to make it better. We're trying to get people to live without cancer. And to do that, for most types of cancer, doctors need to know how much cancer it is, where it is, and help determine the best treatment option. So for like example, the best treatment for some early stage cancer may be surgery, literally take the tumor out, or radiation to destroy it. But more advanced cancer may need treatments that reach all parts of the body, like chemotherapy or other drug therapy or immunotherapy. So the specific care that somebody needs heavily depends on their TNM grading level. And the more refined we get, the better off we are at treating it. This is the problem with the way that we look at alcohol issues. Because historically, for 100 years, which is pretty early in medicine, as you can tell from the story about cancer, because for 100 years we've looked at it, are you an alcoholic or are you not an alcoholic? Do you have an alcohol problem or do you not? What we've done is create a system that offers essentially no help for the people who fall into the no category and offer all the help and a very specific type of help for all the people who do have an alcohol problem. So that is like treating all cancer as yes, you have cancer, or no, you do not have cancer. And that is a terrible way to help people who struggle with cancer. And it's a terrible way to help people who struggle with alcohol problems, which is why the success rates between alcohol treatment and cancer treatment are so completely different. Now, we have a lot of different ways to measure a lot of things. So I'll take this out of cancer for a second and think about it this way. We have height, weight, distance, volume, light amount, sound level, all these different things that we measure in the world, right? Battery level and on your devices. Imagine for a second if we were limited to 2 things in each one of them, like tall or short, light or heavy, near or far, bright or dark, loud and quiet. we would live in a terrible, limited world. You wouldn't have a way to describe anything. Like your battery level, you'd be empty or full. That's all you would get. Somebody would be tall or somebody would be short. It's insane to think about it any other way. And yet we keep talking about this in alcohol and people pretend that it's just a language issue. It's not just a language issue. The fact is that alcohol problems, they are continuous, they are changing, and they are dynamic. We use this exercise in the Ignited program called the severity timeline. And every single person, we've had like 2,000 people engaged in this program, every single person has an up and down sort of graph of their severity timeline. Why? Because alcohol problems are not the same at all levels. It's not an on or off switch. They move around. And we have to be able to ascertain, just like with cancer, how bad is the problem? Where is it? How limited is it? What areas of life is it affecting more than others? Otherwise, what we risk is keeping people stuck at their current level even as they improve, because we don't have a way of measuring and refining and explaining it. Without a refined language in something like cancer, it would be impossible for an oncologist to talk about progress after treatment, because he would only have two options. He or she would only have two options. You have cancer or you don't. So if we went in and we didn't completely remove all cancer from your body, you would still have a cancer and the treatment didn't do anything. And that's a problem, because we have to be able to measure progress, right? People would always fail in treatment if there was no way to say, hey, we moved your cancer diagnosis down stages. We've been able to eliminate the vast majority of it, et cetera, et cetera. Now, whether we did it on purpose or not for alcoholism, and I don't believe that we did. I think we've just had a limited perspective. We've been making a massive, massive mistake. The DSM made it better by moving us to three levels, but you can understand, hopefully, from this discussion that being at three levels for a mental health issue like, you know, alcohol struggles is nowhere near the 48 and more levels that exist for cancer. And that means that we need to get much, much more nuanced. So what we have to do, and I'm asking you all for help with this, is we have to end the term alcoholism. We have to get it out of the equation, right? We have to remove it unless we start introducing a much, much more nuanced, variable way of measuring somebody's struggle. And I think that's what we do at Ignited a lot, but you're gonna see here over the next couple of months, we're gonna introduce an even more refined way of doing. That's why at Ignited, we have the Ignited Wheel of Life, in which people measure their level of functioning in 10 different areas of life, not just around their addiction. It's why we have a quality of life assessment where they grade themselves on 10 different areas, right? It's why we measure reduction, elements of reduction in use, and not just abstinence versus use itself. Only if we create a system that has at least those same 48 variations, I think we should actually get even more continuous than that. Only then will we be able to address individuals who struggle with alcohol problems in a manner that specifically addresses their needs and stop the BS method of treating all quote-unquote alcoholics the same. Just like cancer in different areas of the body that originates from different sources and is at different stages requires completely different treatments, I have news for you. So do alcohol problems. And when I hear people telling me that other approaches that don't require abstinence or other approaches that don't directly deal with the alcohol use itself are failing and are doomed for failure, I immediately understand they don't even know what they're talking about when it comes to the problem itself. If you think alcoholism is a yes or no problem, then you're seeing alcohol problems right now the way people saw cancer 2,500 years ago. And you're behind the curve. It's time to catch up.
Thank you for tuning in to the Ignited Heroes Recovery Podcast. I really hope you found the information here useful and that we'll see you back here next week. And look, I want to make sure that this podcast is the most useful it can be for you. So please let me know by emailing info@ignited.com. If there are any specific topics or questions you'd like to have addressed. As usual, if you like this episode, I would love for you to leave us a 5-star review and rating. Thanks, and see you next week.